Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the host of this show, as well as the director of the nonprofit creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about something near and dear to my heart, and we'll talk about why it's near and dear in a minute. But we're going to be talking about online parent support groups. We'll be talking with Dr. Jay Miller. He is the Dean and the Dorothy Miller Research Professor at the College of Social Work at University of Kentucky. Welcome, Dr. Miller. I am so glad to have you here.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Creating a Family has been involved in parent support groups, primarily foster, adoptive, and kinship parent support groups. Almost exclusively, that's our demographic. Parent support groups for really quite some time. And we developed, this is by way of background, just to explain why my interest is here, especially on the online part. We developed a curriculum that for parent support groups. And we were piloting the first year we had developed it, and the first year for piloting, it was going to be 2020. Well, to participate in the pilot, groups had to agree to start utilizing our curriculum in March of 2020. And we trained our facilitators in January and February. And then we all know what happened. So, but originally, it's truly a mixed blessing. Originally, we had only two of our pilots were going to be online. Everybody else was going to be in person, which from what our research and having been involved with support groups for so long was about right. I mean, the current thinking at the time was that support groups really did need to be in person, and not too many people were even thinking about online. Well, come April, everyone came back to us and said, well, we've decided to go online. So we had to retrain all of our facilitators. And by really probably by May, everybody was then online. The good news is that from our evaluation, we collected data. And from our evaluation, originally, we had thought we would get mostly, obviously, data from in person. But as it turned out, we the exact opposite. We got data from only online for that first year. We're continuing to collect data on all of our groups. So we hope to be able to do some comparisons between our groups, our online and in-person groups. But nonetheless, I have been fascinated by the 2020, of course, everybody was. In 2021, we really thought we would start seeing groups go back to meeting in person. It's been a mixed bag for our groups, the groups. And I'm curious if you've seen that too. Have you seen, what are you seeing as far as groups meeting? Do you think that online is here to stay? Or are you seeing that groups are wanting to go back to in person? What are you seeing?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately, what we have found is that a lot of our groups have wanted to maintain kind of meeting in the virtual space. And I think for us, you know, we had done a lot of work around conceptualizing what these support groups should look like. And the thing that we were really interested in from our standpoint was building the group in a way that took into account the perspective of those who were going to participate. I think so many times traditionally, a lot of the models were kind of like, you know, we had this support group thing and we're going to do it this way. And we just assumed that that was going to work. But we really took a different approach. And so the thing that was really fascinating for us is that with our adoptive and kinship and support groups, we were running them virtual prior to COVID.
Mm-hmm. We were as well, some of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, and one of the reasons that we did is it was really around access. What we found is that, you know, with a lot of the face-to-face groups, we would run them. We had the same loyal group of participants, which was awesome. And they were getting a whole lot of support. But as we saw new folks kind of come on, it really didn't expand until we started offering these virtual options. And it makes perfect sense to think that, you know, it's Tuesday evening, and particularly for adoptive and foster and kinship folks, you know, they have their caregiving and they have young kids, and there's never really a perfect time to do it face to face. And we're always thinking about where we're going to meet that's convenient. And particularly, you know, we're in Kentucky, so there's some very rural areas which, you know, people could find it difficult to get out. And so putting it in the virtual space meant that we were able to reach a number of different caregivers that had not participated before. And, you know, we were joking the other day. I think we would have a mutiny if we try to go back to only face-to-face, because people have become so used to it. They're so much more comfortable. You know, you don't have to factor in an hour of travel time either way. We're able to do them more frequently and more creatively. We have some lunchtime groups that we do now. We have some first in the morning groups that we do. And so it just really affords, you know, caregivers the flexibility to participate and interact with support in the way that they need it. So I think that they are here to stay. And I think moving forward, you'll see that, you know, folks will get that face-to-face interaction in different ways, but that support groups, I think, will be in the virtual space to stay.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I will say that I hope that we see a mix. I do hope to see some, but we'll talk some about some other creative options of doing both. Let me pause here for a minute to tell you about a free educational resource. Thanks to our partners, the Jockey Being Family Foundation, we have 12 free online courses available now for you guys. You can go to the website, and this is a shortened link, and it's bit.ly/JBF support, and that's bit.ly/JBF support. And you can check out all 12 courses. You can utilize them for your foster parent training, in-service training. Check with your agency, but all agencies are accepting of it. You will get a certificate of completion at the end. An example of one course is taking care of yourself when parenting harder to parent kids. If you're parenting a hard to parent kid, you know how important it is to take care of yourself. So pop on over to bit.ly/JBF support. And thank you, Jockey Being Family, for allowing us to offer this. So as I have been researching in this field, I was doing a search in a research library, online research library, and typing in things like online support groups or whatever, and not finding much, certainly in the foster, adoptive, and kinship space. And then I came upon a research that you did called the Virtual Interactive Pilot Program. And I did a happy dance. I was like, yes, somebody is researching what I care to know about. So you became my favorite person all of a sudden, my favorite researcher.
Thank you.
So tell us about what, and you may have done something, I have to admit, I haven't, you may have done other research too, but start by talking about what you found in your virtual interactive pilot program that you did there at University of Kentucky.
Yeah. So like you, when we set out to conceptualize this group, we wanted to take an empirical approach. And I don't mean that to say that we wanted to do something that would be overly academic and we'd write about it in a journal and no one would ever read it. Because that's what happens with a lot of research, right?
Yeah, yes. Only people like me who hang out at research libraries ever see those.
Yes, yes. But we wanted to do it in a very pragmatic way that influenced how people were delivering these support groups. And so we embarked on this kind of multi-phase project where in the first phase, we, from a research standpoint, went around the state collecting and analyzing data around how people wanted to engage with support groups and what they thought support groups should do and how they should function. And we took that data and we wrote some papers about it, but we also used that data to actually develop and build out the full name. It's the Adoption Support for Kentucky Virtual Interaction Program. And we call it ASK for short. But using that data, we built out this apparatus and said, we're going to launch this group. But one of the things that we were really surprised about is that it sounds like you saw the same thing. There were very few research studies that looked at the impact of participating in a group. And so we said, okay, what are some of the things that we would want to see from this group? What are some of the outcomes we want? And we said, okay, you know, we want people to feel less caregiver stress. Why go to a support group if you can't feel some support, right? We wanted to look at what we call parental competence or parental know-how as it relates to adoptive foster. In addition to the parental competence, we also wanted to look at information-seeking behaviors. So, you know, what we found is that when we did the conceptualization research, a lot of caregivers participated in support groups, not only for support, but to get information and share information as a mechanism of support. So we laid out all these things that we wanted to measure. And then as we implemented the group, we embedded the research as part of how the group functioned. So it sounds similar to what you all did. We recruited facilitators who were indeed adoptive and foster parents, so they had that lived experience. We spent a lot of time training them in facilitation as it relates to the virtual space, right? Like anybody who's facilitated a group knows that facilitating face-to-face is very, very different than facilitating virtually. You know, examples are, you know, people tend to get a little, they have a little brave juice when they're online and they say things that they otherwise wouldn't say in face-to-face groups, or you have to kind of manage interactions in a different way. So we took a lot of time to train the facilitators. And then we launched the group and we had a very explicit and clear delineation around how long we wanted the group to function, what we were going to measure when. And then based on that information and process, we started to analyze the data. And what we saw, while it wasn't surprising to us, I think it was certainly a contribution in documenting the fact that folks who participated in the group, they did find an experience that it reduced stress. They did find an experience that information seeking was high and that they were able to seek and get quality information. Parental sense of competence and parental confidence around being able to care for young people increased. And we set it up on kind of a pre-post pattern. And so, you know, we can attribute some of those changes to the fact that folks were participating in the group, and that we really took the time to offer and train and support the facilitators in a way that made folks feel comfortable. And again, they wanted to keep going and keep participating in groups. And from that one test group, we've now launched 16 different groups that we run at various times. We have specialized groups. So we have groups for folks who are in kinship care or foster care or transracial adoption. We've also interestingly moved into support groups for teens. So looking at the young people, one of the interesting things that we found is that, you know, while we were having these virtual support groups, we'd often see the teenagers running back and forth behind the caregiver. And so we said, you know, what would it look like to have a teen group in the same kind of way? And so it gave the teenager something to do while the caregiver was participating in the group. So we've had some initial success with that. So, you know, it's one of these things that we really took the time to build out in a participatory way. And it's certainly something that we look forward to continuing to do in the future and to really innovate and think creatively about how we can best support foster adoptive parents. I think at the end of the day, no matter what we're doing, that's the ultimate aim is to provide a support. Many of us have lived experience in the child welfare system. I spent time in foster care myself, so I know what that's like, and I know the stresses it brings about in caregiving. So we want to make sure that we are doing everything we can to support those caregivers and that we're doing it in a way that's informed and based in data.
Mm-hmm, exactly. We also evaluate, I was listening to, and I knew this having read your research, but we also evaluate for decrease in stress, increase in confidence, and creation of a sense of community. Those are the factors that we evaluate. And we have found a very similar thing. Now, ours are not time limited in that we've created a library of curriculum that people go to, and it's topic based. They can say, oh, I want to learn about ACEs, or we want to talk about ACEs. And it's a turnkey, it's a full service where it's got, you know, the video, the facilitator guide, the handouts, the additional resources and certificates of attendance and things like that. But we have found so we were not necessarily measuring for information seeking, but people who are coming were getting information, which is we have found to be one of the factors, one of the key factors of success for support groups, is that people feel like they, as some of our participants have said, they get some meat. You know, they're looking for something that's actually, you know, helping them. So have you done other research on parent support groups? Particularly, I think that your specialty is in the area of adoptive, foster, and kin, but even without, have you done other research in that, online or otherwise?
So, yes, I mean, we've done a number of different studies, really kind of trying to get to a space where we can better understand how to deploy resources to support these caregivers. One of the things that we just finished up was looking at the mode and modality around virtual networks, because I think Zoom has been the default for how folks have tried to do support groups, which can be difficult to manage at times. Some folks are, you know, sometimes I'll hop on a meeting and they're using Teams, right? And there's always kind of a disconnect, like, oh, I'm used to using Zoom, so I got to kind of react.
Happened to me yesterday.
Yes. So caregivers are going through that same thing. So we've really started to look at modality. Is there a difference if I can see your face versus not seeing your face? How many people should be on the screen? Like, there's all kinds of nuances that can start to impact the way that people engage with groups. And, you know, the same way that we think about face-to-face or physical groups, a lot of those things don't hold true in the virtual space. So in the virtual space, you can have a scenario whereby, you know, frankly, not all caregivers are sold on support groups, right? And we do see some generational distinctions between our younger caregivers, at least in some of our studies, have interestingly been less inclined to participate in the virtual space. And it's more so around getting on with people you don't know, you're sharing your business with folks who you don't know, you may not trust. The thing about virtual that's different is that you might have somebody in far western Kentucky in a group with somebody in far eastern Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And while there's certainly benefits to that, there's also this lack of inherent community, in the sense that I don't know you, you know, we don't have the same worker, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're really getting into some of these nuances around the virtual space and what that should be and look like, and the impact that that can have. And it's not the end of the world if we have, I remember a very clean example in one of the studies that we did, where one of the facilitators, they were kind of worried because people would get on and for the first session, they wouldn't show their face, right? And we get into the second or third, and all of a sudden those people were now on camera and you could see them. And we talked about and processed after the pilot period was over what that was about. And from some of the caregivers, they said, well, you know, we just kind of wanted to check it out. We wanted to see if it was something we wanted to participate in. And doing it virtually allowed them to do that in a way that they wouldn't have done in a face-to-face group. So that's really where we're at now in terms of some of the current research, is assessing what is the ideal platform, what are the ideal ground rules, does it change depending on where you are? We've done a really interesting study around the difference of functioning for virtual support groups in urban areas versus rural areas. And we found some very clear distinctions in kind of how those things operate and which of those groups can be most effective. So, you know, it's one of those areas where we make a lot of assumptions. When we say support groups, you know, folks kind of in their mind, they make a lot of assumptions about what's happening and what's not. And we found that a lot of things that we assume to be true, quite frankly, just aren't. And so it's been fun for us to kind of dive in and tear apart some of those things.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. I'd be curious to know what you're seeing urban versus rural, because one of the things that we've seen from, well, but both that we've seen is also from what research that I have been able to read or been able to find, was that the two of the best examples for use of online is in rural areas for the reasons you just mentioned, you know, distance, but also in urban areas because of traffic or just the hassle of using public transportation or whatever. So again, it all comes back to time. So I'm curious to know what distinction you've seen between urban and rural online groups.
Yeah, so I think first it's important to set the context in terms of support groups are microcosms of the broader world, meaning the same dynamics you see in every 8-day human interaction, you will see those in support groups. And so one of the things that we've found is there's always distinct differences in terms of stress relief, sense of competency, sense of support. Most of the times, the urban groups will feel that those things are higher, or that they have more supports, or that their support groups were more impactful than perhaps an urban group.
Urban or rural? I'm sorry.
Than perhaps a rural group. The urban group will sense that theirs are higher than the rural group.
Gotcha.
And when you start to kind of tease that out about what's that about, well, I mean, we know that a lot of times the resources are kind of central to the urban areas, or at least, you know, here in Kentucky, like you
Everywhere.
Access to things. Completely. And so you start to think about how that dynamic plays out in the support group, and it allows us to frame the support group in a different way. And so if we know that the urban group is going to inherently have more access to supports, we can kind of supplement and take a different approach as it relates to some of the rural groups. We've also found it really helpful to mix the groups up, right? So a lot of times what we find is that they not only learn about the day-to-day pragmatics of caretaking, they also learn and share information about resources. So one example is we had a group that was mixed with urban and rural. And of course, these are adoptive parents, and they're talking about their workers, right? And kind of the resources that they need and their relationship with their workers. And there was happened to be a rural family who had a newer worker, a less experienced worker, who may not have realized that, oh, you know, these adoptive parents are able to access this particular resource. And through this group, it was kind of like I would say, hey, Don, you know, my worker said that you can do X. You should ask your worker if you can do X too. You go ask, and then all of a sudden you're able to do this thing that you never thought you would have been able to do because we decided to mix these groups in a very intentional way. So I think that being able to learn and discern the differences in outcomes has allowed us to build and support the groups in a different way than we otherwise would have, because I think there's a big assumption that they're just all the same. A support group is a support group is a support group, and that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Hey guys, I like to say that friends don't let friends wander around the podcast universe in the dark. Meaning, most people hear about podcasts from their friends, from people they're talking with. So please let your friends, particularly those obviously involved with adoption, foster, or kinship, let them know about this podcast. That is the single best thing you can do for us, because our mission is to get this information in the hands of as many people as possible. And we need people who are listening and who like what they hear to share the news. So please go forth and proselytize about the Creating a Family podcast. We really do appreciate it. So how do you create a sense of community and relationship building with online parent support groups?
In short, very intentionally. I think that it really starts with training the facilitator. So getting to the facilitator and understanding how to manage communication, how to deal with conflict, because it's going to be inherent to every group. Strategies on, you know, there's always someone in a group that tends to talk a whole lot, you know, and kind of take up the time. And so how do you manage that? How do you manage oversharing? How do you manage scheduling? Like, so we spend a lot of time, and we actually have developed a certification program for adoptive parents who want to facilitate virtual support groups. And so all of our facilitators go through that program and get that training. And a lot of that is about kind of building commonality. So we start with, there's a concept that we measured. It's called homophily. Oh. And in short, it's how alike are we, right? So if I'm in a group and I'm asked to measure homophily, I'm asking, how do I perceive these other folks in relation to me? Are we a lot alike or are we not a lot alike? Mm-hmm. And because we measure that and can track on it, it's inherently connected to community as it relates to these groups. So we look at common experiences. We focus on those. We focus on the facilitation and management piece. We focus on really letting the group kind of drive the content. One of the things that we used to do, quite frankly, that we stopped doing was we would give the groups kind of topics like, oh, Tuesday night, we're going to have a support group, but the topic is going to be X. And what happened is there would be a lot of training and information going on, but not a lot of support. Because the topic would kind of overtake the support pieces. And so we stopped kind of scripting them out and really letting the group drive what the content was going to be and what they were going to interact around. And because we gave them and allowed them that participatory input in what was happening, they had a different vested interest and sense of community because they were able to kind of all coalesce around a common experience. And we have found, and we think that that's what works best for a lot of these groups. Again, I think there's certainly a time for the kind of scripted content areas as it relates to support groups, But what can happen if you're not careful is that you get out of balance. And if it's an hour long and 50 minutes of it was structured content, we don't get to the informal support pieces that people may need. So you have to be intentional about creating community, and then you have to set about a very participatory way to get people engaged, get people, you know, asking questions. We do allow kind of in between groups, you know, folks will, they can submit questions to other group members that they then talk about in the groups. So that's been really good in kind of building a sense of community, understanding that a support group is not just the hour or 2 hours a week that you have it. A lot of the support happens in between the actual group meetings. And so creating avenues for folks to engage in that kind of communication interaction is really important. So those are just a few of the things that have worked for us, and we found them to be really fruitful in the virtual space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just going back to the topic versus non-topic, while ours is topic-based, the topic, the giving of information is probably about 20 minutes. And then discussion around the topic takes up the rest of the hour, hour and a half. Well, hour and a half is what we would say. Yeah. So, yeah. So again, that is how one thing that from the sense of community is to create the opportunity to discuss. And in our case, it's discussing around a specific topic, but it is still discussing because that's how we find our commonality.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think even in that model, you know, having a space where, you know, letting your facilitator kind of understand that, okay, on Tuesday night, we were supposed to talk about X, right? Mm-hmm. But on Monday, Y happened. And so being able to kind of adapt and kind of build in, you know, what's happening in the contemporary space with what the topic is.
Exactly.
I think that's a really good way to streamline it. And then also always set aside some time to say, all right, folks,
what's happening in your life?
Yeah. Yes, is really, really
exactly important. Exactly. Hence the keeping of the giving of information relatively short so that they get some meat, but they also get a time to just catch up and also to talk about something different.
I was going to ask a question. Do you all, because I'm really interested in kind of how this may work in other spaces. Do you all allow for, or is there interaction between participants, between groups? Like, so, you know, if we meet every Monday night, are they interacting in between the Monday support group meetings?
They can. Our group, the people who would, they're absolute, we encourage that because we think it's a good thing. Now, some groups will choose to do it and some groups won't. What has been successful is, well, this cuts both ways. We have not utilized it because we haven't seen that it's effective. We have the ability, this is getting a little bit into the weeds. So for the audience, hang on a minute, but Dr. Miller and I are getting into something. So you guys just hang on here a second. We have the ability on our learning management system to create communities that people can then utilize. But more effective, we have found, is to just do a closed Facebook group. The only problem that we have found is that some people are not too many, but there are some who are very anti-Facebook, hence why we have this ability on our learning management system. So, yeah, that's we encourage that, and some groups do. What have you found? I'm curious.
Well, I think it's absolutely instrumental, particularly in the virtual space. And what we have found is that it makes the support group meetings much more fruitful. Like they're starting in such a different place.
Their community building is going on outside of the group itself.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and then too, you know, we'll have instances where there'll be an issue come up. They'll have some chatter about it. We actually used, there's a private social media platform that we use that's connected to RLMS. But it allows people to kind of interact very much like a social media space.
That's what we have too. Exactly.
The same. Yeah. But what happens, I mean, we've had caregivers kind of research a topic that would come up during those interactions and then bring it to the support group, which there's nothing better than having some vested caregivers who are kind of bringing information based on some of these interactions.
Yeah. You know, now I'm curious, have you found that if it's not on, and Facebook is the one, that people are less likely to participate? Because that's what we found, is that when we had it on our, it's a private LMS group. It's basically, it looks like, in some ways, it's more functional than Facebook. But we found that people participate significantly more when we kept it on a private closed Facebook group. Have you found the same or no?
Well, yes. So, of course, you have some folks who they've just been socialized to a particular social media platform. And so that's the one that they think they need to use. I always jokingly say people are as faithful as their options. So if the only thing we give them is Facebook or whatever social media platform, and that's all they use, we would, you know, a lot of times we assume that, well, that's what they want to use. What we have found is that when we give them other options, they choose other options.
Interesting.
And interestingly, you know, we went down the social media road, and for one particular group, what it led to is they started meeting more frequently for shorter durations because of the activity that would happen on social media. And because, you know, sometimes with social media, you can't always offer the supports. Of course, from our standpoint, there's always some risk in terms of what's posted and who needs to respond and the responsibility of managing it.
That's why the groups who don't do it for that reason. Exactly.
Yes. And so I think that it can definitely be a good tool. For us, we have found that like promotion and sharing and like letting folks know, hey, there's this group, it's this time, here's how you access it, it's been extremely helpful. But I think, you know, we have to take into account a lot of the folks that we deal with are in the space of public child welfare, meaning they've had adoptions, they're public foster parents, kinship providers, fictive kin, et cetera. And so there's always kind of some nuanced information, no matter how closed a group may be.
Yeah.
You see stuff on social media. So we always want to be very mindful of protecting information, protecting their identity, more so, you know, making sure that the young people's information is protected. So we've tried to go a different route, and we found it to be helpful in terms of promotion and letting folks know that there's a group. But in terms of the actual functioning, we try to keep that in a different space.
Yeah, I could see that. And the groups that utilize our curriculum, we're not running them. They're running them. And there are a lot of public agencies that are using it. And I think that their hesitancy is that as well. I mean, and I get it. Plus the idea of, well, it's just, it gets complicated because you've got, do we want complaints going on against agencies, and does the agency have the ability to get in there and respond if this becomes a new inbox, so to speak? I mean, it's complicated. We respect our idea, our mission is to increase the number of parent support groups by making it easy to run high quality groups. We don't care if they have the offer, we recommend it, but we understand why they would not. Sure. I'm curious about what, because we get this question a lot. For online groups, and you said you'd done some research, so I cannot wait to hear what you found. How many is too many, or how few is too few? Because we've got a screen, we've got, you know, so how many, how is that? What have you found?
Well, so you might not like the answer, and I say it depends on the platform, right? So we actually went through for Zoom, and we did a lot of research around the ideal number of people in a support group. In terms of facilitation management, et cetera.
Yeah.
Our data and research showed that it was going to be anywhere between 12 and 16.
Okay.
But one of the big drivers related to that was, number one, the platform, meaning how do they show? Do they tile on the screen? Kind of what setup you have for folks to kind of see and interact? And then number two, the skill of the facilitator
was
the number one predictor in terms of perception around, you know, how many people needed to be in a group. And again, if you think about it, it makes common sense. Like if the facilitator can't handle a big group, well, then eight is too many, right? But if the facilitator is able to manage, and I think it also depends on the experience of the constellation of folks you have. If you have a bunch of new folks, you might want that to be smaller, at least in our experience, we found that. Whereas we have more seasoned caregivers, we want that to be bigger. We've also found, and we call them specialized groups, but I wholeheartedly believe, and there's data to suggest, there's times when you mix caregivers in terms of adoptive parents with foster parents, with kinship providers, et cetera. But I've always been very clear, and I've even said this in some of my research studies, every one of these caregiving groups has a very unique set of needs.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we kind of paint them with a broad child welfare brush, and you can't do that when you're thinking about providing support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I say this about kinship is, it is so much more complicated than foster parents. Foster parents, just
sure
simply because of a familiar relationship, right?
Yeah.
And so you have to deal with that and support that in a different way. And I don't mean to say that anyone is worse than another. I simply mean it's all different.
And, you know, mixing, we don't run that many groups ourselves as an organization. We run a couple, but I could not agree with you more. In particular, mixing mixing foster and adoptive parents seems to not, we've had good luck with that because a lot of our foster parents are also adoptive parents. So it just, that has seen, there are some differences, but that seems to be a pretty easy combination. But we have not seen that mixing kinship parents with foster or adoptive parents. And it's because their needs are different. And I also have talked with kinship providers who have said, and I don't know that they actually were being judged, but their feeling was that when the foster parents or the adoptive parents were frustrated at the birth parents of the children in their care, that kinship parents felt like, well, they're viewing me in that same light. Mm-hmm. And there was also the kind of the shame of how did I end up in a situation? It's just all the complications, as you've just mentioned. So I completely agree with you that I think in particular, kin needs to be. The problem is then how do we get enough kin? Because we also struggle to get kin to participate. So anyway.
And that's why I think virtual, that's the key. And I think that, again, I always say the biggest difference between people is not race and it's not gender. It's generational. In terms of, we're in Kentucky. In Kentucky, we have the highest proportion of relatives caring for another relative in the country. And overwhelmingly, those are grandparents raising their grandkids. And so one of the things that we've often tackled is kind of the tech divide around, okay, if you say I'm rolling out a virtual group, a lot of my grandparents who are kinship providers, they're not just readily going to hop on and start that. So we've kind of planned all kinds of initiatives, again, like getting the teens involved as a mechanism to assist the grandparents in getting on this virtual group, which was a really kind of creative, neat thing and worked out splendidly in terms
of. How did you do that? Did you get the teens their own group? Or did the teen come on to help their grandparent get
well, we kind of started with the concept of we're doing this support group. It's around kin providers. And then we kind of went down the road of really targeting teens to say, look, we need your help here. Like there's this tech gap. Now, I will say, I think sometimes, or if not a lot of times, the tech gap is overblown.
But totally agree. We have found that.
We make assumptions about,
ageism. It's ageism.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. But it is very real in spaces. And then sometimes it's not about functionality. It's about trust, meaning they know how to do it. It's just taking the time and, sometimes just getting over the hump of participating in a group. If I can get the team to put the Zoom up and get it going and, hey, ask your relative to get on. We got a question for him, her, they. And that's been the way that we've went about kind of building that apparatus. But then also, too, again, it's back to these kind of specialized groups focusing on, aunts and uncles and siblings. Like there's not enough discussion around that those kinship providers. We often think about grandparents and we need to. Mm-hmm. But we also must think about these other groups who they're there and they're caring for these young people. We just don't think about them as much. So I think that one way to get them involved is by deploying these virtual platforms. And then, starting with, we identified what we call support group champions. So we got a couple of caregivers who were really all about support groups and the impact they could have. And I tell you, your best salesperson are the caregivers themselves. And so they would go out and recruit people to be in their group. And, in some of the places we would have somebody who they would kind of submit a form. They say, hey, we want to start a support group. We want to start a virtual support group. And we say, okay, well, you got to have 8 people, here's some resources, but you got to have 8 people to start your group. And they would go out and I tell you within 2 hours, they call us back and say, I got the people, we're ready to go. So really kind of engaging them. We gave them some training. We called them the support group champions and they would kind of go out and talk about the impact that support groups had for them. And I think ultimately when you're quote unquote selling the concept of a support group, people have to know and understand how it's going to benefit them. And that's just the brass tacks of it. And yeah. The caregivers are the best. I can spout all kinds of research and talk about all kinds of books and papers that we read, but there's no better narrative than a caregiver saying, I was able to get through this tough time and I was able to do that because of this support group.
Yes, you're right. So you looked at different platforms. You said Zoom, Microsoft Teams, and I imagine Google Meet would be in there too.
Yep.
So were there differences between, and are there other platforms I've just left out? And are there differences between them?
Yeah. So there are a number of different platforms that we looked at. And again, I think it goes back to facilitator preference, like which one are they strongest on? And then there were some just around kind of setup that people, I think we've been in COVID long enough that most of them now are easier to set up. When we started doing a lot of this work, again, it was pre-COVID. So, you know, we were kind of, I remember we were talking about Microsoft Teams and Google Hangout, and a lot of people didn't know what we were talking about. Like it was only 2 years ago, but we forget that there was a time when we didn't do all this stuff.
Yes.
So, you know, for us, it really boiled down to what was going to be sensible, what could be managed. We also looked at access on your device. So which platform worked best on which device? Because interestingly, we have a lot of folks, and we found this in our research, that were accessing the virtual groups on their phone.
We found the same. Exactly.
Yeah. And so different platforms perform differently on different types of phones. And so we got into looking at, you know, are you right-handed or left-handed? And what kind of phone do you have? And what kind of, you know, where's the app on your screen? All of those kinds of things that would impact how people would interplay. And I think the thing you have to know with the virtual groups is that while it's very easy to access, it's equally easy to not. Meaning, if I try to get on and I can't figure out the login, I'm done. I'm not gonna call a bunch of people. I'm not gonna go through that. Now, if I've drove out to the church up the street to attend a group, I'm there. Like I'm staying there, and I'm
gonna find the darn door if I can't find it. Exactly.
But if I'm at home and there's a bunch of other stuff going around and my show's about to come on, I'm just as likely to X out as I am to log on. So a lot of it would boil down to accessibility and really working with the facilitators on the platform that they preferred, assessing the accessibility, and then going through a screening process for their participants in terms of what they had access to, how they were going to access, times of day, what else was going on in their house. You know, one of the things we never thought we would have to deal with is Wi-Fi capacity. I'm a big believer in there's not a set time for support groups. Like everybody always has this like Tuesday night at 7 or Thursday night at 7. I'm like, no, you build the group around what's convenient for most folks, right? And so we had one group, they were going to do a 9 o'clock group because that's when everything was convenient. And what they very quickly figured out was that was also the same time that a lot of the teenagers were logging into school and such. And so there were Wi-Fi issues in terms of access. Again, something we never thought we would have to think about in terms of a group, but we did. And so the platform can vary. At the end of the day, it's all about access or accessibility. It's all about the comfort of the facilitator in managing the tool. And then in terms of general functionality, I think we're to the point now where most of them have similar functions in terms of muting and seeing you and facilitation. We've went through, you know, do you want to do it in webinar mode? Do you want to do it in tile mode? Do you have your setups where if somebody's speaking, they pop up big and everybody else is small? Those kind of nuances we worked through.
Did you find any of those were better or did you find any difference between any of those things?
All the
platforms have it. But
for us, when everyone could see everyone on the screen, the tile versions at the same time, that was what was most preferable. And quite frankly, we actually did some analysis that those groups yielded the highest changes in support.
Interesting.
And so makes sense. While you would never as a researcher equate it to only that, it's certainly a factor from the perspective of the participants of being able to see everybody at the same time. You know, there's a lot of interactions and reactions and people making faces and things that go on that you can read a lot into if you can see everybody at the same time.
Absolutely.
So that those are kind of the key functions. And again, I think what we've learned is it wasn't this way when we started, but now a lot of the functionality is the same. So it's really opened up the avenues in terms of being able to offer virtual support groups.
I want to thank Hopscotch Adoptions for their longstanding support of Creating a Family as an organization and Creating a Family, and this podcast from Creating a Family. They have supported us through the years, and I just cannot tell you how appreciative we are for their support. Hopscotch Adoptions is a Hague-accredited international adoption agency placing children from Armenia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Georgia, Ghana, Guyana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, and Ukraine. They specialize in the placement of children with Down syndrome and other special needs, in addition to doing kinship adoptions. They can place children throughout the U.S., and they offer home study services as well as post-adoption support to residents of North Carolina and New York. So what is your experience with what we're loosely, I think everyone's calling hybrid groups, and that's a pretty broad definition, because a pretty broad category. It can include things like having in-person groups at the same time and have virtual participants in the in-person group. That's one idea. And the other idea that we've seen groups trying to use is have the same kind of program, but do it in person, say on Monday at noon, and then virtual Thursday night at 7. You know, the very same type of thing. We're going to be talking about adverse childhood experiences and what all that means. And we're going to, if people are interested, we're going to take the adverse childhood experience quiz, and then we're going to talk. So that's another way. So what has been your experience? And there may be, I am sure there are other ways. So loosely speaking, in the hybrid, what's your experience?
Yes. So we've tested all these. The hybrid, at least for us, does not perform as well as the other groups.
Do you mean the hybrid where there is a person, the virtual and the in-person are at the same time?
Yes. Where essentially you have a facilitator trying to manage the physical as well as casting people in. And I think it's really just that it boils down to the logistics.
It's hard.
And in terms of balancing, if I have 3 people face-to-face and then 10 people virtually, what does that mean? How do I balance that? There's also, in talking to some of the participants, and we did these qualitative interviews for some of the groups, there was a differential trust factor in terms of the people I was with in the physical space versus the people that I was interacting with.
Yeah.
And I think that makes perfect sense. And so we've been very clear that we are going to have either or. But we are going to build in spaces to interact in person. And so a lot of times those will be more of our social events, our picnics. We're very careful to not frame them as support groups per se. Don't get me wrong, they're support groups, there's support definitely happening. But we want to be very clear about the model and delivery in terms of the avenue that we're going. I always caution to say, ultimately, every group is as unique as the people in it, meaning there's a unique composition of dynamics when you get folks together. And every group has a character, meaning collectively, a collective character. And so you should always try to do what works for your group. And some people might like an on and off kind of situation, or a face-to-face virtual, we kind of alternate in weeks. I think the blended, meaning at the same time, it gets really tricky for the facilitator, and that hasn't worked for us. It's not to say that it won't work for other folks, but I think simply managing that, and I can tell you as an educator, you know, when we went through COVID, I run a fully online academic program, I run a hybrid program, and I run a fully face-to-face program. And the hardest part of COVID was having people in the seats as well as virtually trying to be beamed in. It just makes the management tricky. And, you know, you're talking about some really deep, heavy things in these support groups. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, trying to manage those, and there's always somebody like, oh, hey, speak up, I can't hear you, you know, the Wi-Fi goes out and y'all sound like a robot. There's all these kinds of things that can factor in. I think it's much better to, at least for us, to have it one way or another.
Yeah. Where do you see the future? I mean, how do you see, and the other thing, let me back up, which is actually feeds into the question of where you see the future. We have made such a huge jump in technology in the last 2 years. And as you well pointed out, people's ability to access the technology has also even a bigger jump there. Where do you see the future for support groups and online? Do you, and if you had an ideal world, where would, what type, what do you want the platforms to be able to do?
Well, Ms. Dawn, I tell you, I ultimately think we're going to get to a space where we have to ask the question, do we still do face-to-face groups? Like, what do we invest in them?
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And I tell you, if you really want to know the answer, and I say this to everybody who's thinking about doing a group, schedule a virtual and a face-to-face at the same time. And the participants will tell you which ones they want to participate in, by which ones they show up to. I think for a lot of us, even myself, if it's March and the weather's nice, it sounds really great to get out and go to my car and drive to a support group. Like that sounds, you know, pleasurable. It's different in December when it's dark at 5 o'clock and it's freezing outside and or the kids, they're not quite acting right or there's some school stuff going on. And so we have to think about access and how we can have the most access or get people the most access to these groups. One of the things that we're working on now around some simulation is the VR space, where I tell you, I have an 8-year-old and he'd been asking for this Oculus VR video game situation, apparently. And of course, I don't know a whole lot about it, but he finally convinces me to get one, and I get one, and it gets to the house, and it's late at night, so he goes to bed, and I start kind of tinkering with it. And like 4 hours later, when I've been on here playing, I become a believer because, you know, you start to kind of see the potential, and it's almost as if you don't realize you're not there. So you get all of the benefits of a face-to-face space with none of the hassles of having to access it. Now, please, I am not saying that there's not value in the human connection. I'm in social work, right? Like I'm all about being able to connect with people. But in the support group space, I really think that's the direction we're going. One of the next things that we're looking to pilot starting in June is a fully kind of a VR virtual reality support group where we have a small group we're piloting. You know, all of them will have access and get these headsets. And we're going to work through what a support group looks like in that space. And so I'm really excited to kind of test that and see what happens. But I think that that's the future because the technology is getting so good to where you could participate and not realize that you're not there. And I think once it gets that seamless, that's going to be the preferred mechanism. You see it now. You know, I read something where the Super Bowl, you can go to the Super Bowl by putting on this headset and you'll be front row and it's 360. And the tech is really getting to a space where we can do these kinds of things. I joke with my folks all the time. If I can get on my phone and text and pull up and get somebody to bring my groceries out to my car, we should be able to figure out how to do this efficiently. So I think that's the future. I think we need to do it responsibly. I think we need to do it ethically. We need to ensure safety of people and information. But I think we're getting to a point where we have those possibilities and it would be neglectful of us to not explore them.
Wow. I cannot wait to read your this. I cannot wait. And I promise you, I will share this widely. I am fascinated by this. Thank you so much, Dr. Jay Miller, for being with us today to talk about a topic, as you can tell, I am fascinated by, and I love the research you are doing. And I am so very appreciative that you're doing it. And so thank you. And thanks for being with us today. And everyone else, see you again next week.